Okay, good. Excellent. So, hello and welcome here to the next session in the main hall of the DAPConf Taiwan 2018. I'm now here with Professor Dr. Wolfgang Maurer from Germany, Regensburg, which is a city in the south of Germany. And you're working with the University of Regensburg, but also with the Siemens Corporation. And I just learned that Siemens actually has already an open source competence center for more than 10 years. So this is pretty cool. And of course, you have a lot of products like with Linux and embedded Linux. That's your personal background. Today, you will also like give us more information here about the research that you are doing and especially analyze Debian. So the title of the talk is, Are Any Big Brothers Watching You? And if yes, what can they tell about Debian? Of course, we want to know that. So big round of applause for Professor Dr. Wolfgang Maurer.
Yeah, thank you very much for the introduction. Actually, that's, I think, the longest title I've ever given to a talk that I submitted somewhere. And are any big brothers watching you? The answer is, of course, yes, because if not, then the second question wouldn't have made any sense. As you already said, I'm kind of a split personality, so I do work in academia with some fraction of my time, but I'm also involved with Siemens corporate research, and yes, we're doing lots of projects based on Linux. We've had an open source competence center for more than 10 years. It goes even further back than I've been working for Siemens, and quite many Siemens products actually use Linux in its various forms. So for instance, that's bad angle for the laser pointer, I realize. For instance, the leftmost device is a magnetic resonance imaging tomograph that runs a special combination of Linux plus a real-time operating system, Xenomai, if that rings a bell for you. Then we have a device that does communication. The next device doesn't do communication. It's a SIMATIC, it's an industrial controller. Then comes a mobile X-ray device, again running in Linux. Then comes one of our communication platform. And the last image is supposed to represent the research, the more fundamental research that we're doing at Siemens Corporate Technology. I've also done a fair share of documenting and writing about the Linux kernel, some even in languages that I cannot even read. So I've learned that it does seem to make sense what's on the last two images in the bottom row, but personally, I cannot judge that. That's me on the cover, 10 years or so younger, taken by a professional photographer and photoshopped. But it's really me, so I was involved in producing this picture. Now, why am I here speaking here at DAPConf? It's actually my first time addressing you guys at DAPConf, so I'm typically more found on the Linux Foundation events, Embedded Linux Conference, and so on. But part of that, part of the reason is that as Siemens, we are sponsoring this year's DAPConf because of our involvement in the Civil Infrastructure Platform, and the Civil Infrastructure Platform is also part of the reason why I'm telling you about the stuff that I'm about to tell. Coming to Debian, so coming here, I was wondering when actually did I start using Debian first? I've never been a Debian developer. I've only been involved with Debian as a user, but that goes back for quite a while. And I do remember one of the questions that I thought about, should I be using Debian or Yggdrasil? Back then in time, Yggdrasil won because it came on a CD-ROM while I had to install Debian from 3.5-inch floppies, which meant carrying such a stack of floppies home. But actually, I've run a Debian on quite a few architectures, x86, ARM, Spark, PowerPC, you name it, Alpha, Itanium, PA-RISC. When I first compiled the list, I got a bit depressed because I realized how many architectures that I've run Debian on are not even available on the market anymore. And that, I guess, just means one is getting old. C'est la vie. Anyway, before I start discussing about what I wanted to discuss, I'd like to know a little bit more about you. So here's three target audience check questions. Who of you has done academic software engineering research lately or is an academic? OK, okay, that's kind of a minority. Who of you has read about software engineering research lately? Okay, that's a few more, but also not too many. And who of you has attended a software engineering conference? Any of the named lately? An academic software engineering conference, I would say. Okay, also a few, which is pretty good, because I feel when I talk to people, when I talk to researchers, when I talk to developers, there's a certain disconnect there, of course, between research and between the people who do the actual software. There are, of course, certain exceptions to these rules. So one is sitting right here doing research, presenting research on Debian conferences, but as I've seen from my quick survey, that's obviously not the case too often. So it may make sense to discuss this topic, and what I wanted to discuss today is how research, what kind of research is done that either targets Debian, that uses Debian as a foundation for research, or that can have bring positive influence to Debian. So in the first part of the talk, I'm trying to sum up a little of the research by other people that has been done in the last 10 years or so that somehow relates to Debian. And then in the second part of the talk, I'm going to delve a little more into details of one field of research that's currently becoming very productive, namely the socio-technical analysis of large-scale development undertakings. Number three is then, I'll see if I have time for that, is more meant as an interactive part of the session, because I also have some questions for you, some more questions, and would like to know your opinion on certain things. So what's going on in software engineering research currently? So as a big fat disclaimer up front, of course the software engineering community is it having as easy to find a common opinion as all the Linux developers have it to find a distribution that suits everyone. So what I'm saying is, of course, my personal subjective opinion, but I'm not going to prefix every sentence with that. In my personal subjective opinion, some current trends in software engineering research are about, one, migrating this field to empirical, quantitative, and evidence-based methodologies. So we used to have lots of opinions, a lot of guesswork in earlier years of software engineering, but people are transitioning to make that quantitative and really turn it back into an engineering discipline again. And there's also lots of interest lately in automated software engineering and construction, because we've come to realize that doing software is maybe too hard for humans, so we should get all the help from computers we can get. Why does it make sense as scientists to investigate Debian, to do research on Debian? Of course, I don't need to tell you that. It's one of the largest collective engineering undertakings of mankind, which makes it interesting in itself. But the main advantage from the scientific point of view is that there's a lot of publicly accessible data behind that. So you have mailing lists, you have bug trackers, you have all kinds of freely accessible data sources that simply do not exist in commercial projects of a similar magnitude, and that can be analyzed with various methods. And that can then help science to understand the really important questions of software engineering quantitatively. How should we do development? How should integration happen? How do processes work optimally in software development, and so on. As for the civil infrastructure platform, I've already mentioned that, and as for Siemens, for other companies, there's one solid reason why research about software engineering and about these more softer aspects of software engineering, like processes and methodologies, is becoming more important. And that's because, I've said in the beginning, Linux is used in very many non-traditional products. So your average nuclear magnetic resonance machine is quite different from your laptop. Trust me, if things go wrong in this machine, it's also quite different from your mobile phone rebooting and so on. These are systems that need to satisfy very strict safety requirements. On the other hand, they need to provide more and more functionality, and that means people are really getting into using Linux in these very demanding safety critical fields, which has its dangers and which requires a certifying software that comes from the Linux domain that has not been written with safety in mind. Actually, there's three different ways to get software safety certified. So one is start from scratch, start development from zero, do standard compliant development. That's obviously out of the question for Linux, so no one wants to start the Linux kernel again. But you can also argue with proven in-use arguments. You could say, hey, I've been using Debian on my Spark station for the last 25 years and no single fault ever happened, so let's do it. Let's put it on a magnetic resonance tomography machine, of course simplifying things, and you could also do compliant, so-called compliant, non-compliant development, which necessitates you to prove certain aspects of the development processes. And of course that's only possible if you analyze processes, if you can make quantitative statements about the processes. And that's the general goal of analyzing the softer elements of software engineering. I've already mentioned the civil infrastructure platform. That's one of the reasons why I'm interested in this kind of research. The civil infrastructure platform, you may have seen our booth. You know that we are sponsoring the conference. The civil infrastructure platform is dedicated at bringing Linux into such areas. Not so much from the safety point of view as of now, but from the super long-term maintainability point of view. So you may replace your mobile phone every year, every 2 years, maybe every 3 years, but you certainly don't want to replace your nuclear power station every 2 years. You don't want to replace your magnetic resonance tomography machine every 2 years. You don't want to replace your industrial control in your big-ass industrial plant every 2 years. But so these devices are supposed to last for 10 years, for 20 years, even longer. And that's the interest of the civil infrastructure platform initiative of the Linux Foundation to provide such system, which of course creates strong interest in many things. For instance, in long-term support of the distribution itself. So we're supporting Debian LTS, strong interest in reproducible builds for various reasons, but also interest in these research topics I mentioned, namely automated software engineering and especially quantifying processes, identifying when processes work well and when they don't. So, coming back to analyzing Debian, of course, the process analysis and related things is just one, a particular subfield that people have been working on by analyzing Debian. And I promised in the submission of this talk to outline the research that has been done about Debian or using Debian and so on. Turns out that's pretty hard to find some objectively representative examples. I already mentioned this problem. It's always hard to talk about other people's work, and I'm trying in this first part to focus on other people's work, and that's hard for two reasons. First, because a lot of software engineering research is published each year. Hundreds of papers is maybe totally underestimating the amounts. People often use Debian but don't mention it explicitly. When they analyze, Debian is typically mentioned, but still any choice I would make is subjective and unfair. So I decided to go with a more, perhaps more objective and fair methods. Go to Web of Science, that's a science database, search for the keyword Debian, then select the papers I get, and then maybe select work that cites this or work that builds on this. Of course, that still gives a very subjective and unfair choice, but at least superficially I can claim that I have made efforts to do this objectively. As a result, I'm going to first talk about a number of papers, about 30 of them. Of course, apologies for not being able to covering them in detail. That's quite impossible in a one-hour session, but I'll try to cover them as good as possible. For the next slide, I already apologize in advance. So I thought, for that one, I don't apologize yet. I'm going to apologize for the next one. These 33 papers I've classified into broadly five categories where people are interested in dealing with Debian. That's, of course, improving software quality. That's the foremost goal of software engineering, in analyzing communities and cooperation. So here we're getting into a more non-standard topic. Testing and analyzing code at large scale, which is, again, a fairly obvious thing to do. Understanding licensing and code sharing. Of course, that relates very much to open source software. That's also very much or very close to the heart of many Debian developers. And then finally, as the last category, research that focuses at improving Debian itself. So now that's the slide I'm apologizing for, and also for the four other ones. I really tried to make to present the the papers that I was mentioning in a more graphical or entertaining way, but turns out it's simply not possible. So I'm just listing the authors, approximately the time when the research appeared and what it was about, and we'll comment a little bit so that you get an impression what people are actually trying to do with the help of Debian. And one of the earlier papers that was dealing with improving software quality in general with the help of Debian was by Chan and Wagner in 2007. A large-scale analysis of format string vulnerabilities in Debian Linux. That's, of course, a very interesting goal for every software developer, especially if you're dealing with C and C++. What they came up with is they could analyze a very good fraction of all C packages in Debian, so they used Debian as a data source to get their hands on as much C code as they could. They analyzed about 66% or roughly 70% of all the C files in the Debian distribution. Back then, that was Debian 3.1, and found a whopping 1,500 string vulnerabilities that could be possibly exploited. Okay, they estimated that about only 85% of them are true positives, but still that's a quite scary number. And they also managed to get rid of quite a few of them in the course of this research. So that is quite an impressive work. Moving forward a little more to the present, Adams and friends, especially the name German or Daniel German, we will hear quite often on this list, was research published about an empirical study of integration activities and distribution of open source software. And that distribution of open source software, one of them is, of course, Debian. So they were able to find some patterns that package, or they were able to identify some integration patterns that people actively use in everyday development. And the nice thing about that is they really did not just do a theoretical analysis, but talk to some actual maintainers in Debian to confirm or refute their findings, and then basically documented these for everyone to benefit from the wisdom that comes from Debian. The next paper, source file set search for clone and reuse analysis. That's a typical example of research that builds on the large data sources provided by Debian. Of course, developers do like to copy and paste on occasion, but the question is, how often does that happen? How does that influence source code quality, or does that influence software quality? And they came up with an academic method to evaluate these questions, or to find source code duplicates in the Debian ecosystems, and then at least roughly quantify the magnitude, how often that happens. Good, and finally, the last paper, the DEP sources dataset, that should surely ring a bell with many of you, because one of the authors used to be a Debian project lead. That turns out to be a quite recurring pattern. So many Debian project leads tend to publish academic work. So in that respect, there is already quite some connection between Debian and the scientific world, at least when it comes to the leaders. And this data set, I guess you all have heard of, maybe you're all using it. It comes from academic research, but builds up a faithful representation of all the data that they can get their hands on. And by sharing it, they're enabling a huge amount of data for other researchers that can be analyzed, that can be used to benefit from Debian. So communities and cooperation, that's a quite different topic that's not really, or that has traditionally not been so much in the focus of the core computer science research of core software engineering. And again, the first papers I'd like to mention come from one of the previous Debian project leaders. The first one, I spelled his name right, I think, so he lacks some vowels. And that was one of the early studies, on how people actually cooperate in software projects, in large distributed software projects. Back in 2003, doing something like Debian, building a volunteer-based large system was to much of industry a bit of a shock, because they were only used to these traditional top-down, hierarchically organized development undertakings. And what these authors did was not yet formalizing or making quantitative statements, but really capturing the essence of the Debian development process and the Debian approaches that have been found useful so far, led to a number of subsequent papers that I'd not like to discuss in detail. What's interesting is that a couple of years later, the knowledge that there are actually alternatives to traditional management style even spreads to the outside the engineering domains, like the second paper from the Information and Economics Policy Journal is quite not related to computer science, but they also used insights from the Debian distribution to teach different management styles than the traditional ones to the world. Yeah, the paper by Wang, that's an example of a long, of a large amount of papers that started to look at the problem of how people cooperate, how communities are formed, and so on, more quantitatively. The subject that Wang's considering is a very special one. So they're looking at email archives from Debian and then try to infer if someone writes an email to any of the mailing lists, how likely is it to get responses, how likely is this or that developer to respond, and so on. And it turns out you can do that pretty reliably with machine learning and statistical techniques. Okay, question, of course, is what's this good for? But that's not really the essence of research. It's already amazing that you can tackle such problems, such very social problems, in a quantitative manner. And the last the last three papers are a very good example of the Debian community being made the guinea pig of actual research, maybe with knowing, maybe without knowing. So many of you perhaps have participated in any of the key signing events at Debian conferences, and then you surely have heard the name Wolf. If you didn't know that, you've contributed to actual academic research by doing proper key management in your function within Debian, then these are the papers that you may want to look at. Testing and analyzing code. That's, again, at large scale, I should mention, because testing small code is, of course, not so much of an issue. Testing 50,000 packages produced by thousands and thousands of developers is a completely different matter. That's the subject of the next category. And so the first paper I'd like to mention seems like a very straightforward one. So on the distribution of source code file sizes, done in 2011 by Harais and friends. But that actually, and that of course also was, this study of course was performed on the Debian distribution because it contains very many files, so it seems like a good place to go for if you want to measure file size distribution. And what they surprisingly came up with is that many of the previous assumptions on how file sizes are distributed in large projects are essentially wrong, so they need to be described by different distributions. But if this is wrong, if people have been using wrong estimates for that previously, that means that many of the models that we use to compute the value of software, the economic value of software, make predictions on build time, make predictions on bugs, and so on, are essentially flawed. Good, going on, mining security vulnerabilities from Linux distribution metadata. That's a work that goes into the more into the testing portion of this category. And what the authors did is they were interested in how do security vulnerabilities within Debian evolve. They are of course getting fixed as far as that's possible, but how do they track across releases? How long does it take? Are we getting better at that or not? And they only could do that because there's all this historical data available in the bug trackers in the open forums. That's again an example for research that's simply not possible if you don't have open data sets, if you only rely on proprietary and company endemic code. The next paper by Krönig and Tauschnig, the research done in 2015, is, in my opinion, particular very, very interesting because it raised one problem that's known to many developers in the real world, but that's not known to many researchers in the academic world. Because what they did in this paper is actually very simple. They took some existing research tools and tried to apply them to the Debian universe. Of course, the result is that the research tool broke in most of the cases because it's typically optimized for some very special cases. It's not optimized for all the bells and whistles you find in real-life source code. It's not optimized for the volume of data you're dealing with. But this paper turned out to be quite a win-win situation for both research and Debian because on the one hand, by applying the tools to Debian, they managed to improve their tools, managed to fix bugs in their tools, fix corner cases and so on, but they also contributed lots of bug reports back to Debian 700 in this case. And in case if any one of you would have been bored before 2015, then you should have had lots to do after this paper and this work was done. Good, in the last paper, let me just briefly skip over that. That's a classical example of applying testing approaches to large collections of software. So in this paper, the authors could prove very specific properties, deadlock freedom for C programs in an impressive amount of cases, 292. So the community, I guess, doesn't learn too much from that immediately, but it's at least reassuring to hear that it's impossible to detect many common bugs in your software repositories. Good, moving on to licensing and code sharing, a topic that's obviously very, very specific to open source software. And I guess I'm progressing further in time than I would like anyways. I'm going to just quickly summarize what people did here without getting into the details, but it's basically, it's two types of approaches that people are doing. One is using source code analysis to detect any incompatibilities in the licenses that are combined in Debian packages or in the distribution at large. So finding basically spots where legal changes are needed to make sharing of source code legally okay again to comply with the open source licenses. And Another aspect of this that I'd like to mention is that Debian still can set can bring surprising input to other fields of science. If you look at the third paper from top, the 2013 paper, that's actually from physicists. So I'm a physicist by education, so I can fully understand the problem, of course, in physics. And that's a quote from a physics conference that I'm giving now. When it comes to software, everyone thinks they're Moses. So a physicist, of course, would never listen to any computer scientist on how to write their software, how to package the software, and so on. And that's why it was possible in 2014 to come up with a paper that basically said, yeah, so we're packaging software. Astonishingly, there have been people who have done that before, and maybe we shouldn't do this our own way, but use the same tools, formats, and so on that Debian uses. So if you're in physics, you can invent a Linux distribution or reinvent the Linux distribution in 2014 and still get that published. But that's, again, one of the nice effects that distributions like Debian has. And finally, coming to the last category, research about improving Debian as such. Here I'd like to highlight especially two approaches. So one again, the first one is again from one of the former Debian project leaders. So we've had three or four of them already. And what he did was actually superficially a very simple task that usually wouldn't be regarded by science as interesting if you don't care for the details. If you start caring for the details, you of course realize that this task is very hard. And the task was to rebuild Debian as quickly as possible, rebuild the whole Debian distribution as quickly as possible. In 2009, if I recall correctly, there was about 10, 12 or so thousand packages, so already quite a lot. And it took about a week to build the whole system, which is naturally bad if you want to do automated testing, if you want to test reproducible builds, if you want to roll out releases and so on. And the goal of this paper was a really practical one, namely use one of the largest French distributed computers, the GRID 5000 machine, to rebuild Debian. The paper itself is very interesting because there's so many problems that you wouldn't expect, that range from packages not being able to build in parallel to vastly different builds, times, and so on, that a lot can be learned from that work. And that's also a very nice example of research that directly benefits Debian, because he could, by using these large shared resources that are now these days standard, if you think of cloud computing, he could really bring down the build time of Debian from weeks to roughly, I think it was eight hours or so, so a very, very small amount of time. The other papers basically are applying research on Debian and then in some way or another contributing it back. So to not spend too much time on that anymore, I just invite you to look at these papers. The links are all in the PDFs that I will be distributing, but they're all very good examples for doing interesting research based on Debian and immediately feeding back improvements to Debian itself. So, as I said, I did already apologize for listing 5 pages of references, but I really couldn't find any better way to introduce at least some representative sample of research about Debian. So let me come to the second part that will be more pictorial, which is the socio-technical analysis part, which is due to the fact that I'm going now in a shameless plug to focus a little bit on my own research that I did. So it's not so much about the actual papers. Of course, lots of people have contributed to that research field, and I don't want to outline my own research too much. But I'd rather like to discuss the fact that actually many of the problems or software development to a large extent can be reduced to 2 problems mostly. And I guess many of you know these 2 problems. Problem number 1 is it's about technology. So software is about technology, and technology is hard. This is a pictorial representation of the Tower of Babel. You may be more likely to be aware of that if you come from a European background. So for those with a non-European background, that was an attempt by people in the early ages to build a tower that reaches up to the heaven, that reaches up to God. Very massive engineering undertaking, and of course that failed. Tower broke down, people spread all across the world, spoke different languages, and so on. People in Taiwan, if I think of the Taipei 101, of course do better these days, but still it's quite a way to go up to the sky and to heaven. So problem number 1, software is about technology. Problem number 2, software is about people. And this image, I guess, even less of you are supposed to know. It's a very famous black and white movie in Germany, basically about 2 people, 1 Catholic priest and the leader of a socialist party in post-war Italy, that want exactly the same thing: for the people to be happy, to be nice to each other, but totally cannot agree on how to achieve these goals. I'm pretty sure you've never heard of this problem in Debian. You want the same thing, but there's multiple ways to reach the thing, and then you discuss ad infinitum to reach it. So second problem, it's about people. And that's where the research field of, so here we are, where the research field of socio-technical analysis comes from. The idea is to combine knowledge about both aspects, the social aspects and the technical aspects of software development, to arrive at better software development methodology. And of course, nothing is better suited than open source software to get information on the social and the technical aspects of software development, because it very often comes already in combined form. So social information is contained in many of the artifacts that we are creating in software development. As an example, I'm taking a commit to a software project, but you could find similar things in many other artifacts that appear when you do, when you create distributions, when you do infrastructure work, and so on. The commit, as you see in the bottom part, you all are very familiar with commits, so I don't need to spend much time on that. The commit does not just contain the actual patch or the actual diff to the project that does the technical change, but it also contains lots of explicit and implicit social information. For instance, in Git, you have an author of a commit, you have a committer of a commit. That creates a social relation between two persons. In some projects, you have these developer certificates of origin, for instance, in the Linux kernel, that tell who reviewed the patch, who acknowledged the patch, maybe even who was against the patch. That create an effective social relation between two persons, and the social relations directly come with the technical change the change brings. So, and that's, of course, the ideal data source to come up with, to consider socio-technical aspects of development, of software development. Question is, how do we leverage these data to construct collaboration networks? So which of the social connections I mentioned do we use best to come up with appropriate representations of the social structure of projects? How do we determine which developers are influential, which are central to the network, and which are not? And that's not meant in the sense that this should be used for finger pointing or giving badges to people, but just in the sense of how stable are development networks, how well structured are they, and so on. And how do we identify communities? How can we arrive at conclusions if the community structures we find are good and bad for software development? So constructing these networks is a topic of its own. I'm not going to discuss any of these methods in detail, just observe that there's a lot of different possibilities to construct these networks, both for relations between people as well as relations between software development artifacts. So of course, not only people, but also artifacts are in some kind of relation with one another. Detecting communities, analyzing network properties, and so on. That's also quite a standard problem of science, and actually, and when I did this first, most surprisingly to me is that sociology, there is quite some mathematical aspects to sociology, and they really came up with many approaches to find communities, to quantify these networks, to assign properties to these networks, and so on. That can be readily used in the socio-technical analysis of software development. So here's an example. If you just take the data that you have and try to find a collaboration network. That, for instance, is for the Linux kernel. That, of course, is maybe not the most easiest one to interpret. So you need to bring that down to more digestible form, to form that can be better comprehended. And that, of course, involves finding communities, finding sub-communities in this large network of people. Unfortunately, I don't have a picture ready for the Debian community. Could be easily created, but essentially it would look very much the same as that, so no information, you need to boil it down to easier to digest units. And that's, of course, subgraphs, clusters, sub-communities in the developer network that you can find with many, many existing tools. Okay. Just to give you an example, just to give you a little rationale that these approaches really work, QEMU. Many of you may know QEMU, the virtualization and simulation software, system level simulation software. That's a very nice example that you can really see how the mode of cooperation, how interaction between developers changes over time. So QEMU 0.11, that's a very ancient version that was mostly running as a hobbyist project back then, created by Fabrice Bellard in the way he maybe usually does things, create them just out of boredom and to show that things can be done, like booting a Linux kernel in a JavaScript simulator in a browser, or writing a universal system simulation software that can provide support for any hardware that you like, and so on. And you actually see that, so people got interested in that project. It's not the early phase of the project, but you see in this graph, nodes represent developers, the size of node represents the relative influence of a developer to that project, that there's one developer that has a really large node that basically makes up the project with some smaller, very small nodes attached to him. So these are the contributors that give him patches, but in the end of the day, it's the the main developer who does the actual work. That, of course, is not a good structure if you want to rely on a project, because consider the truck factor. What happens if the largest node is hit by a bus? Then you very likely will run into coordination, into sustainability problems. So moving on with QEMU's version history, at some point it became, or QEMU became one of the core components of virtualization systems like KVM or commercial solutions, and then people really started caring about what will happen to the project if things go wrong. And so the development structure changed. QEMU 0.13 had, a more apt structure already, and with QEMU 1.5.0, that's still an old version from today's standard, but that's at the height of the whole cloud and virtualization time. Just a second. You see that this QEMU, really evolved into a social collaboration structure that every textbook manager would really like. So you have people who are responsible in each sub-community. It's a manageable number of sub-communities. The communities are large, but still not infinite, and so on. So what we do actually does make sense and can be objectified. So you have a question?
Sorry, I'm trying to make sense of this graph visualization. So. Is the connections and arrows representing something of the node relation of the nodes?
Yes, so the nodes represent developers and the arrows represent cooperation relationships. For now, just forget about the direction of the arrow. If there's an edge between two nodes, that means these two nodes, these two developers, do interact in one form or another.
How do you define the interaction?
So I've said there's multiple ways to define interactions. For this case, we're defining interaction as people who have contributed to a common software development artifact, and the artifact in this case is either a function or a class. But there's also other ways, like this commit-author relationship or reviewing one's patches and so on, that essentially leads to the same results. No. So the question was, did you use this and that theory that I don't know? And then the simple answer was no. Could you repeat the name of the theory that you mentioned that I don't know?
There is Ganter und Wühle. They have published in Springer a formal concept theory. You have a number of concepts, and you have a number of properties, and then you can connect these together. You can filter them out according to a certain algorithm, so that you have a source and you have a sink, and then you can split up in possible good choices, the best choices there are, according to a certain filter. And it's used for files and for many things. So you can find it in Springer Verlag.
Okay, yeah, that's something we should look at, but the short answer is we haven't used it for that work.
Having read so many of these papers, what is your sense about how often the data collected and analyzed in these projects is being used to support the Debian project?
That is a question that brings me to the end of the talk. So I wanted to skip a few slides anyway, so that's a good opportunity. You can tell lots about the networks that you find, about the properties of different types of networks, what these properties mean. For the communities, for progressing with the communities. There's also lots of work being done to ensure that these networks are accurate. So, but given all that, the question is, if I understood your question correctly, how could the Debian community or other communities benefit from this kind of work? And that's precisely one of the points why I'm presenting this here. So I said, we will need more of this information. We will need to be able to quantify the social aspects of a project when it comes to safety certifying or certifying other aspects of software projects.
Yeah. I would like to disagree that you do not need more data to support Debian. Mm. What you need is to support Debian. So if you have anything that can support Debian, you can use it to support Debian. You do not need more data to do that. So if these papers are providing information that helps us understand how this project should improve, it would be nice if there was an emphasis among academics that these are applied research papers, mm-hmm. they're not just basic, and that yes, there is something to learn about Debian in mm-hmm. terms of applying it elsewhere, but Debian needs that help.
Okay, so I see. So basically what you're asking is why don't we give back the data to Debian to support
how
Debian?
How to encourage it. I am encouraging you okay. to encourage others.
Okay,
yes.
So actually that's things we're trying very actively. So firstly, let me point out that, of course, all the analysis that I've presented here, I had to skip over a lot of them, of course, but that's all based on open source software. So we're publishing all our data, we're publishing all our methodologies, it's on GitHub. There's no Debian package for that because this whole thing is basically unpackageable, but that's just a detail problem. The issue is so, and of course, that brings me to this point, to the BOF thing. What I would like to ask you as an at the end of the talk, as an outcome of that, as I said, I had to skip a lot of methodology, but that is to learn what the actual questions are that you think make sense to be analyzed in that way. So are there any spots where you say, okay, so we're unsure how to proceed best, there's different approaches how we could do that, how could we get answers by doing this type of analysis. But there's also a thing that we would need from Debian for that, and I said you can argue well that the relations you obtain from these results are correct in a certain sense, but this certain sense is only statistical. So without going into the detail, there's some statistical techniques that you can use to validate the networks that you infer. But in the end of the day, you need to really check it against the knowledge of real people. You need to validate that against the knowledge of real people to ensure that you're not just analyzing anything. Because the problem we're dealing with here is you can, from any data, you can come up with arbitrary connection graphs. So you can say, and collaboration graphs, you can say, committed to author is the social relation to go for. You can say, analyzed cooperation at the file level, that's the way to go for. You can say, analyze evolutionary dependencies, that's the way to go for. That'll give you a graph. And then on this graph, you will run some clustering algorithm that will give you communities, but problem is a clustering algorithm will always give you a community, regardless if this represents reality or not. And that's the point where we need the input of actual developers, of actual people knowledgeable of the system.
Relating to the previous topic, I have one question that might be useful to us. Mm-hmm. I see you analyzed several, or your community has analyzed several projects like QMU, LLVM, mm-hmm. and I bet you analyzed some big projects, small projects, successful and failure
yes.
ones.
Yes.
So is it possible to predict, like 10 years from now, how Debian will look like from the present clustering or structure, mm-hmm. will it fail or will it have been a big success or mm-hmm. will it split or something like that?
These are of course very detailed questions, so it's only possible to predict the future in a limited way, but that's a field that we've been considering, and there are actually, I didn't cover that slide, there are actually some patterns that you find in successful open source projects, how they grow, how their network properties change over time, and that is to a certain extent an indicator how a project will do in the future or if there are any corrections needed to the way a project is run. So for instance, LLVM, as you already mentioned, would be an example of a healthy and successful project that follows a typical pattern. Other projects like Node.js that may have slightly more trouble than projects like the Linux kernel or like LLVM don't follow this pattern, yes, and that If you want to predict such things, then looking at these kinds of data would be the appropriate thing to do. Of course, feel free to come to me afterwards and tell me more about the specific aspects that you find worthy of analysis.
thanks. So following on from the theme of sort of the previous questions about prediction and getting more data, so as you said yourself, given any constant set, static set of data, it's possible to analyze it to whatever degree you want and come up with whatever conclusions you want, like arbitrarily pick specific specific properties to look at. So I think like asking for more data would sort of just basically repeat that same mistake of coming up with whatever conclusions you want based on more and more data. So for me, sort of the scientific method really is to be able to, is to aim for being able to make predictions or prescriptions to test the future or to try to adapt or to do something different in the future. And that's really what actually tests whether a theory is true or not. You can't sort of test a theory, you can't be sure whether a theory is true or not, even if it's a very sophisticated or convincing sounding theory, unless you make predictions or unless you make prescriptions of how we can improve ourselves and have those predictions or prescriptions be justified in the future using unknown future data. So, I guess echoing also the previous opinions that more data isn't necessary at this stage. It's to actually convert the existing data that we have to actions or predictions.
So actually, I don't think I was really asking for even more data in the sense of that we need more projects, that we need more source files, that we need more communication. So what we have right now in terms of communication data and projects and so on is already very much and quite sufficient for our purpose. Maybe if I said that, then I said it wrong. But what we actually need is verification by experts, because the arbitrariness I was referring to comes from, say, clustering. Clustering will always produce your clusters, and you can use statistics to verify that basically the clustering you found is either highly improbable, so it's likely not right, or highly probable, or whatnot, again, without going into details. But the real proof point is if you analyze people and their social interactions is the actual people. And if they say, okay, that's about how I perceive it, then your method at least is likely to be right.
But then this is sort of subject to the biases that experts have as well. And I guess by experts, you mean people that are sort of well embedded in the communities.
Yes.
I'm somewhat well embedded in the communities. So maybe I fit your definition of expert, but I wouldn't be confident in my own self-analysis of what reality is like. It would only be if I could make predictions or if other people could give predictions to me that I would then be confident that these things
are. Of course, I totally agree. Just taking time into account, I'd like to cut this off
Thank
now,
you.
But rest assured that we have a whole lot of psychologists that take care of exactly these questions that you raised, that are very good questions. And in the end of the day, let me just close with, so I hope I've sufficiently raised your interest or raised you to disagree with me, that we will come tomorrow on Sunday after this talk, whenever, to some discussions about the topics I've shown you. But with that, thank you very much, and I don't want to keep you from rockets any longer.